Hey everyone, thank you for listening to my podcast. I've really discovered my mission and focus, if you can tell, at least from the last few episodes, something that I have decided to call, as a genre, historical intrigue. It's the distilled focus of my podcast, and as much as I like conspiracy, eschatology, and the prevalence of genuine metaphysical gaps in the human experience, it occurred to me that I cannot be all things to all people, and yet those subjects will be broached, but through the eyes, the writings, the experiences of the people, places, and things about which I am podcasting. Odd that it took me 5 months, yes, literally I think tomorrow is 5 months to the day that this podcast exists, and it took me that long to arrive at this conclusion, but I have learned that there's a miles-deep chasm between the concept of, quote, making a podcast, unquote, and figuring out the mission. So far, I've got listeners in America, Canada, Sweden, Serbia, Australia, Argentina, India, the Russian Federation. I think I mentioned India, the United Kingdom, South Africa, Singapore, Turkey, Ireland, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Brazil. And I don't think that I've actually hit all of them. I'm just looking at my metadata from my login platform. I cannot thank you enough for listening. I'd like you to know I would like to hear from you. I've said this before. My email is box7@yahoo.com, spelled just like it sounds. No hashtags, no cute curly Qs, nothing like that. I'm also now on Twitter and X and Instagram, and both of those are identical, @box7, spelled just like it sounds. If you're in a conciliatory mood, please give me written reviews on your platform of choice. I'm on all of the major platforms, to include Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Deezer, Amazon Music, the Podcast Index, TuneIn, and Pandora. And please, if you don't want to write, just give me a star rating. I'll leave the determination up to you, but if it were me, I'd give me 5 stars if I were a completely independent soul, devoid of bias, tendencies of insider trading, and clandestine deal-making proclivities. Anyway, so thank you all again. This thing can only go up from here. At least I hope so. Some great shows are coming up. Peace out, homies. It was 2 a.m., June 29th, 1967. Truck driver Richard H. Rambo was headed down Highway 90 in an 18-wheeler headed for New Orleans when he felt a sudden impact on the back end of his trailer. Rambo had downshifted on the 2-lane highway to accommodate flashing lights from a utility vehicle coming from the other direction. By the time he realized what had happened, he was staring at the twisted frame of a 1966 Buick Electra with significant carnage apparent. And by the time the newsprint had consolidated the manifest of names in the car, aside from 3 injured but alive children, 3 adults were unequivocally dead. Ronald B. Harrison, attorney Samuel S. Brody, and his companion and client, Jane Mansfield. All 3 had died instantly and gruesomely. The series of details would become marred in misunderstanding, malappropriated quotes, and macabre assumptions taken from the photographic evidence. Equally disturbing was the evident body of one of Mansfield's dogs in the foreground, adding even more horror to an already horrific photographic account. But it would be other touted relationships that would add a seemingly supernatural component to the scenario. A rumored romantic entanglement with the reigning satanic guru of the day, promulgating his campy, media-savvy San Francisco form of the occult. Could this relationship have, by extension, affected our own personal safety in the long run, even in a positive sense? We'll look into this and other things at box number 7. At the time of Jane Mansfield's untimely demise, there were two photographs that were dominating the cultural landscape in that exact moment. One was the presence of a blonde wig at the crash scene, initially presumed to be Mansfield's severed head on a dashboard, and furthermore perpetuating a stubborn myth to this day even that she had been decapitated in the car accident. The second one, however, was one that would become linked to the first one. A picture of the young actress kneeling in deference to accept communion from the reigning avatar of Satanism and the ultimate author of the Satanic Bible, Anton Zandor LaVey. He will become an individual who will pop up intermittently in this podcast as his cultural connections are actually far and wide, no matter how seriously or non-seriously you take him as an avatar of the ages. LaVey was enjoying meteoric exposure in the press at that time, and especially in 1967. He was articulate, he was media savvy, he was kind of suave and able to channel whatever angst was remaining in the 1960s into something that retained the ritual and dogma of a pseudo-Catholic slash liturgical nature, but catered directly to the sexual revolution that was underway as well. I heard his daughter say in a podcast recently that despite his lack of belief in anything, his form of Satanism was Abrahamic in the sense that he required the Abrahamic framework in order to be contrary to it in the way that he structured his form of religion. When he painted his Victorian San Francisco house black, the house notoriously located at 6114 California Street, he became the cause celeb for a number of high-profile notables, Sammy Davis Jr. and Jane Mansfield being but two, and rumors to have been consorting with many, many different rock and roll bands, and ultimately the Eagles, who I will dive into that another day. Whether they deny it or not, it's still a great little exploratory venture. Jane Mansfield was also a grounded master of media manipulation. She lived in the shadow of Marilyn Monroe and was frequently accused of attempting to reinvent the celebrity wheel using Monroe's template. Now, this wasn't entirely false, and as she did make a conscious decision to trod in her shoes, only with more pronounced steps. This became apparent when it was revealed that she had engaged in a sexual excursion with President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, a scenario already rumored and later pretty much commonly known to be undertaken by Marilyn Monroe herself. So whatever Monroe had done, it seemed that she was willing to raise the bar on extremes to include just how far she would go to use her sexuality to open the floodgates. And when news of Monroe's strange and mysterious death came to her ears, she wondered out loud, looking at the newspaper, if she was next. It was this need for publicity, this desire to rise above the Marilyn 2.0 persona that most likely placed her in the middle of Anton LaVey's living room in San Francisco, getting baptized in the name of Satan and generating at least the rumors that they were more than just acquaintances. Indeed, LaVey's pandering to sexual hedonism was the perfect match for such speculation. All that was needed was the very suspicion for both of them to find the publicity mutually beneficial. The timing for Mansfield was also the fact that she was already on the decline in terms of her career, at least in terms of Hollywood's inhumane treatment of the shelf life when it comes to reigning sex symbols, and especially females. For LaVey, it was a chance to parade a high-profile convert that validated all his alleged claims to the beneficial sides to his brand of Satanism. He would publish the Satanic Bible 2 years later. Mansfield was in a public relationship with her attorney, Samuel Brody, at the time. When he saw Mansfield's suggestively satanic and ceremonial photos, presumably taken from the infamous Black House on California Street, He went and he confronted LeVay over the matter. It was not lost on LeVay that Brody happened to be married at the time he was staking out territorial claims on Jane Mansfield. It was purported that LeVay placed the now legendary satanic curse upon Brody, one that would presumably remove him from this terra firma. This, of course, makes and invokes a number of responses. One, the fact that LeVay didn't even believe in an actual Satan, that he took the Crowleyan doctrine of do what thou wilt and wrapped it in a reverse polarization of Catholicism, using its ritual and dogmas as a starting point and then pushing the reverse button on that. Thus, any quote-unquote spells he cast were simply parodies of actual ones and should be taken as such, right along with the ridiculous costumes he was wearing at the time, to include that stupid horned cape outfit that he was so fond of wearing. Of course, I don't minimize his impact in any negatives that went on, and there are plenty of people who claim that LeVay had a lot more going on behind the scenes than just some sort of cartoonish avatar of the occult. But of course, somehow, in the midst of this, after he pushes this curse, there are 6 car wrecks involving Jane Mansfield. 6 car wrecks in 1967 alone involving Mansfield and Brody, as a matter of fact. All of them, of course, non-fatal until the infamous crash number 7 referenced at the beginning of the show. 7 car crashes. Your mileage may vary, and your skepticism levels may be somewhat parabolic in this case, but at least I'm willing to say something bad was going on behind the scenes, no matter how you want to define it. LeVay admitted to all of this on camera, by the way, although he claimed the curse was meant for Brody alone. But no matter what the inertia and whatever originated the crash, authorities were presented with a most macabre scene. Mansfield was thrown from the car and landed on the shoulder of the road. Contrary to the fantastical decapitation claims, her head was partially bifurcated or scalped with a loss of skull and brain tissue, or as the death certificate reads, quote, crushed skull with avulsion of cranium and brain, unquote. Other fractures and lacerations were noted in that report as well. Brody and Harrison remained intact in the car, but were fully crushed on impact. Notably, the 3 children had been sleeping in the back seat, and some witnesses saw Mansfield stop at a diner called the White Kitchen prior to the crash, where the kids were moved from the front seat to the back, where they laid down beneath the impact line of the truck. 2 boys and 1 girl. 8-year-old Mickey, 6-year-old Zoltan, and 3-year-old Marie, who suffered the most trauma, by the way, as her head became lodged in the bent wreckage and had to be cut out, and she maintains a scar on her head 58 years later to this day. Mansfield's death would be one of the most reverberating. In fact, the fact that her career had ebbed to the point that she was consigned to a life of a nightclub performer would be echoed in the life of the man who placed a curse on her, as well as Anton LaVey's satanic carny shtick would also begin to bore the general public. He, too, would be consigned to playing clubs in the 1990s and was calculated to have a total asset count of a mere $60,000 by the time he died in 1997. But 2 things emerge that do continue to this day. The first being a safety feature installed on the backs of industrial trucks, a downward protruding striped barrier that prevents a vehicle from shearing off under an 18-wheeler, a feature that didn't exist prior to this. Laws were amended to make them largely mandatory. Today, they are known as Mansfield bars. And while initial reports about insecticide fog and ensuing visibility problems has largely been debunked as the cause of the accident, no other known answers have really emerged as to why the crash occurred and how it so violently left behind 5 children without a mother, 3 in the car and 2 that were not present and were somewhere else. those three injured children, 8-year-old Mickey, 6-year-old Zoltan, and 3-year-old Marie, who grew up to profess that her mother's bombshell persona covered up an IQ of 163, fluency in 4 languages, and how her real life defied the avatar of assumptions and shallow, misappropriated ideas about her mother's personality and affect. And she remains her mother's greatest defender even today, or as you know her today from television's Law and Order, Mariska Hargitay. And this is Box Number 7.